There are such, and part of this is about how you write this story, that it's written in a way that brings people along. It seems strange to talk about it being, you know, entertaining, but it is. I mean, there's humor, there's peculiar characters in here as well. Is there, from gay vampires on down, is there any particular strange character in this that stands out to you?
Well, the guy who wrote about gay vampires, as far as I know, he wasn't a gay vampire, but yeah. The characters in here are endlessly fascinating to me, both the bad guys, and there were many, but also one of my favorite bad guys in all of this. I love the sort of match, the dramatic match of like really evil ambition and also really petty failings. Mm-hmm. So one of the guys in the United States that a lot of different fascist groups wanted to install as the fascist dictator in the United States if they could overthrow the government was a retired general named George Van Horn Moseley. And Moseley very much entertained the idea of being this kind of figure in the United States until the U.S. Army came to him and said, "General Moseley, we understand that you would like to become the Führer of the United States after our democratic system is overthrown by you and your friends, but as long as you continue to agitate for that, we're going to have to pull your pension because it's awkward for us, as you know, the army." And he actually kind of stopped doing what he was doing because he didn't want to lose his pension. And you just think like how the world might have turned if you hadn't been so petty and greedy at such a small scale. There's amazing figures like that. There's also on the good guy side, there's a guy named Henry Hoke, who was an advertising executive or a direct mail advertising executive who had a lot of expertise in direct mail. And with that expertise, he actually sort of went into a very intense one-man investigation to figure out why it was that propaganda produced in Berlin, produced by the Hitler government, was flooding the United States, including through the offices of members of Congress. And he was just a direct mail advertising guy, but he played a pivotal role in exposing what was a really big scandal at the time.
She says, "Here's a letter from our son in France." And then he says, "His next letter will be from Berlin."
"Oh, everybody unrelax with warmest of personal lorries to scary part of show. Puzzle a box." Young guy.
Tony, pick that up.
"Hi, Mr. Announcer. Hi, kids."
"Okay, young guy, you look ready for first letter from a fanatic young wrister."
"Oh, you bet. Mickey, where letter from?"
"Hey, this letter postmark deep space. Little Bobby Bunny, 15-year-old, say he got tough riddle question for you."
"A letter from a rabbit? I'm gonna take a letter down to hindquarters for psychoanalysis."
"Oh, stand back, Bradshaw. Rodonodo programmed for female defense."
"Oh, Mickey, what the little Bobby want to know?"
"Bobby asked Mr. Question he first read carved into Great War of Mars. Why does a porridge bird raise his egg in air?"
"Sounds like a trick to me, Fudge."
"Oh, yes, an old trick puzzle. So happens we finally answer it tomorrow next show."
"Oh, yeah? Oh.
Now, everybody go away. Then come back and listen to a new adventure called Dream Monster Egg Fool Young Guy."
"So how about that, Mr. Smarty Pants Communist? Mr. College Professor, Mr. Beatnik, Mr. Hippie, what have you done for me lately?"
"Well, I..."
"Mr. And Mrs. Smith, go to the people. Ask the hands that serve the machines of America.
Hey,
ask these thousands of folks here who wouldn't say no to yesterday or yes instead of knowing it all.
Ask the postman.
Hi, Mr. Smith.
Ask the mailman.
It's two postmen times three animal control officers divided by two gas meter readers makes how many bendable integrated community workers? Decode your answer now." "Did you remember to carry the bomb? Good."
Dips Hotline, this is Anthrax, Ashcroft.
"Mr. Ashcroft, I'd like to report some suspicious activity."
"Are you a loyal American trucker, letter carrier, train conductor, ship captain, utility employee, or other?"
"Sir, I'm a loyal American meter reader other out here on Crystal Meth Road in Elmertown, and I'm getting a big surge of power in a residence out here."
Good tip. "If it's an indoor pot factory, we can take it out with a weed-seeking Rocky Max 2, but it could be men of the desert persuasion."
"Who?"
Arab son, pumping up the heat to simulate their homeland conditions. Look, Tipster, can you take somebody into custody or something?
No, sir. I just read the numbers going around the little windows and report...
That's more than they'll let me do. Listen, this conversation is strictly Orange Alert Sub Rosa, and I'm not even talking to you, right?
Anything you say.
I didn't say anything.
Right.
Now get inside and see if they'll offer you one of those little cups of sweet coffee.
Sir, I don't drink coffee.
Then would you wave, please?
Huh?
Look up and wave.
Okay.
Say cheese.
Limbaugh.
Got it. Now you'd better leave the area, Tipster, so as not to incite any collateral damage. The Immigration Ranger Squat Squad is only minutes away.
Sir, can I get a copy of my picture?
Of course you can. It's all part of Operation TIPS, your volunteer Homeland Terrorism Information and Prevention System. Train now to be the extra legal eyes and ears that the feds need to get up close and personal with neighborhood terrorists. It's toll free, 1-555-666-TIPS.
You mentioned Charles Coughlin, Father Charles Coughlin, who is born in Hamilton, Ontario. And this is a bit of a broadcast of his from 1938. Have a listen.
Thus, for his collective safety, the American Jew must repudiate the atheistic Jew. Communism must be stamped out, else an illogical world will build up a defense mechanism against it in these United States, paralleling, if not surpassing, the same illogical defense mechanism which operates under Nazism.
Time stops for Jew. Berlin, 1933. A local Jew and resident, Friar Yaakov Bertman, ended his sojourn in the Wannsee district with a fall. Falls down. Laughing all the way was the way he went, said the Englishman Lieutenant O'Rakehill, Lord Marlowe. It reminds me very much, he said, lighting his Afghan, of a similar incident involving also a Jew in the very district of this war-torn self-same city. In 1965, he paused and resigned himself languidly to watching the flaming Afghan run out the door. It was in 1964-05 I was telling Peter Bergman this joke about a bloke who comes into a pub and orders a pint of bitters and knocks it back and then pulls out his Peter and pisses all over the floor. Anyway, I knew the end of the story then and I had the accent down and he fell off the couch laughing and broke this pocket watch he had just bought. His last watch!
How much power did he have?
I believe there's an argument to be made that he is the most powerful media figure that has ever existed in the United States. He had 30 million Americans listening to him on a weekly basis. And it is one thing to have a lot of reach. It is another thing to be really radical. But to have those things combined is a form of power, dark power, that I don't think we've ever seen surpassed by anybody, by any media mogul or any media figure. And he was able to organize his listeners into an armed militia. The Christian Front, whose members were put on trial for sedition in 1940. He really is a singular thing. And I think the Catholic Church letting him out on that kind of a leash, knowing what he was doing for so many years, at a time before the Catholic Church even considered anti-Semitism to be a sin, is something that ought to be, I think, reckoned with more broadly in the Catholic Church in North America. They should also get credit for ultimately yanking him off the air not long before the United States actually joined World War II. But they let him build an armed fascist movement in this country effectively in the name of the church. And it was a real deal. It was a serious and violent threat. They stockpiled bombs. And what they planned to do was kidnap and kill up to a dozen members of Congress, to bomb sensitive sites in the New York area that they hoped would set off effectively a war against the Jews. They hoped to set off pogroms by hitting Jewish sites, by hitting sites that they believed were communist sites. And they hoped that it would cause so much chaos, there would be a state of emergency. They believed they had a lot of National Guardsmen and policemen in their ranks. They believed the National Guard and the policemen would welcome them onto their side of the fight. And in a sort of accelerationist race war against Jewish Americans, they would emerge at the top and be able to turn the U.S. government in this sort of emergency panic into a dictatorship along the lines of Hitler's rather than the democracy that we had.
There are a number of other figures in the book. One is Philip Johnson. I'm talking to you now from the CBC Broadcasting Center in downtown Toronto, a building that was partly designed by the American architect Philip Johnson. He has, which is wild in and of itself. he has this starring role in your book. What was his role in promoting fascism in the United States?
Philip Johnson, as a young man, before he was ever a famous architect, before actually he was even an architect, it was a very wealthy young man, very influential young man. He was so wealthy that he was able to effectively set up the architecture and design program at the Museum of Modern Art in New York because he was able to fund it himself. He funded his own salary and all of his staff and thereby created that part of MoMA. He was operating in really highfalutin circles in New York arts and culture, while at the same time he was literally going to Germany to go to Hitler Youth rallies and was in close contact with the German government. He started writing as a correspondent for Father Coughlin's publication. He was sent by Father Coughlin's publication to embed with the Germans when they invaded Poland. He wanted to start a fascist pro-Nazi movement here in this country that would install that kind of a dictatorship. He attached himself for that purpose, first to Huey Long, who was the sort of demagogic governor of Louisiana, mm-hmm. and then senator from Louisiana, who was then assassinated in 1935. And after his assassination,
Is this the movie that's on?
Let's watch Highway Patrol.
Patrol. You mean the old series Highway Patrol?
This is. They've got a bigger write-up. This must be the end. This is the end thing of the series, I think. An interesting episode. An interesting final episode, as Lieutenant Broderick Crawford goes after his toughest assignment, tracking down Lieutenant Dan Matthews, who is a character in a middle 1950s television series called Highway Patrol, starring Broderick Crawford, where everyone drives around in cars on endless location shootings in Fullerton and on Mulholland Drive in Hollywood, and where Broderick, as Lieutenant Dan Matthews, keeps saying 10-4 and 2150 by with that surly, mushed-mouthed manner that he, Dan Matthews, perfected in his portrayal of Huey Duck, murderer of the South, in All the King's Screenwriters, 1946, a drama of how fascism might even come to this country.
No.
He assigned, sort of attached himself to Father Coughlin, and in fact built a podium, a platform for Father Coughlin in Chicago for use in a speech that for Philip Johnson had been directly inspired by what he saw the Nazis use at their rallies in Potsdam.
How did he not pay a price for that? I mean, he had a pretty good life after trying to bring fascism to the United States, designing buildings, as I say, including this one. How do you understand how somebody like that goes on to be ostensibly a respectable member of society?
Excellent question. Yeah. How does that happen? I mean, in the epilogue of the book, we have a quote from one of the Rockefeller donors to MoMA saying that, every young man should be permitted one large mistake in his life.
It's a pretty big mistake,
this is a pretty big one. Yeah. And with Philip Johnson in his history, I mean, there's excellent biographies of Johnson that are out there. And this is a known thing about his biography, but somehow it has to be rediscovered every few years. You know, architecture schools have to remove his name from prizes and buildings and stuff as people remember this. But I think the reason that it didn't sort of preclude his rise and his rise to the pantheon of American architects in history is because this history is easier to forget than remember. Mm. We like to think of the World War II era as us good guys here and those bad guys there. And we went over there and beat them and that was it. And that feels great to think of ourselves that way. And it doesn't feel as good in some ways to know that there were a lot of Americans who wanted us to side in that war, if at all, with Germany, with the Axis, and who wanted that sort of form of government here and who were just as violently inclined and just as rapidly anti-Semitic as the people who we told ourselves we fought against and beat. It doesn't feel as good to remember that.
My fellow Americans, this morning at 6:25 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, combined elements of the Imperial Japanese Navy and our forces ruthlessly attacked our naval base at Pearl Harbor in the Hawaiian Islands. I have conferred this morning with the Congress and the Chiefs of Staff in emergency session. We have reached our rendezvous with destiny. It is our unanimous and irrevocable decision that the United States of America unconditionally surrender.
But A, it's worth it. It's worth knowing that this is the truth. And B, it's worth, again, I think learning from the people who recognized the danger at the time and who fought to expose it and head it off.